lot of owners and what they have as well, because we operate for other groups, not just ourselves. So we're seeing other people. And I think it's starting to moderate in Florida as of right now, and actually coming down a little bit, because I think they've had a pretty good year without a lot of claims.
You're listening to Ice Cream with Investors, a podcast that is dedicated to teaching you how to better invest your money so that you can live a more intentional life. I'm your host, Matt Four, and it is my goal to teach and empower you to remove the roadblocks to your financial success.
All right, Dan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, Matt, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. A big fan of your show, man.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, then we like to start with the difficult questions. What's your favorite ice cream?
Yeah, I'm ready for this one. There's a place called Amy's Ice Cream. I'm in Austin, Texas. That's where I'm based, and I lived here now for 3 years and 5 years total. So big fan of Amy's Ice Cream. But you got to go Mexican vanilla, and they call them crushins. So they chop up whatever you want. But I go with Oreo and Heath Bar. And you crush that into the vanilla. It's amazing.
Love it. Fire. So they have an Amy's at the airport, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
They do. Yeah, that's the same Amy's. It's a local chain that just became massively known as like one of probably Austin's best ice cream, right?
Yeah. Well, maybe our listeners know this. I used to live in Austin for about 18 months, right once it became cool in 2015. And mm-hmm. I remember flying out of the Austin airport one day, and they had a guy in there that was doing the crushing. And then when he was done with it, he would throw the ice cream up in the air and catch it in the bowl. And obviously, when you see something like that, you're like, okay, I got to try this out. Yeah. He did mine and like even threw it behind his back and caught it behind his back. And I'm like, okay, I'll tip you double what this ice cream is worth, because that is very impressive right there.
Yeah, that guy's my hero. Yeah.
Well, tell our listeners, what's the scoop? What do you do today?
I'm focused on real estate, you know, especially investing in real estate. Our firm is called ATX Acquisitions, and it's a firm that basically was launched only about 8 or 9 months ago. And I can go into my real estate background later on in the show, but this one was launched because we see massive buying opportunity, and that's because the interest rates have taken such a historic spike, you know. So by historic levels, they're not nearly as high as they have been. Even you know, if you look at the 80s, they went up to 20%. So what we're dealing with now is something different. But what I'll note, though, I was listening to, I don't know if you've ever listened to Kathy Wood. She has like ARK Innovation and all these other, she's more of a tech investor, but fascinating person who does amazing research in the market. But her point was, in the 80s, when they spiked it to 20%, that was a 2x fold, twofold increase in interest rates, went from 10 to 20%. This time was like more of a 20x increase. So the spike is just hitting people really, really hard. And what we're seeing now is, as you would expect, and you read about now, is buying opportunity, because people, they bought at a very high basis on the real estate asset side, and then they put floating debt on it. So that's a perfect storm. And then other costs have increased too, property taxes and insurance. If you're in the markets we're in, which is primarily Florida and Texas, insurance has really, really hit people. So at the end of the day, a lot of people want to hold longer, but they just can't hang on. So we feel like, just like Buffett, you know, when other people are fearful, get greedy. And that's what we're trying to do now, is we've raised a fund and we're going after buying opportunity.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show is through my research, you have some of the best contextual understanding of property market trends from 2008 to what you just mentioned in the 80s and what I would call the savings and loan crisis that happened here in America. Mm-hmm. A lot of great real estate entrepreneurs, that's when you saw that they made their big buys and kind of slingshot their career. But to help contextualize some of the questions I'm going to ask around that, take us back to, where'd your real estate journey begin?
Yeah, man. A long time ago, basically, from, you know, essentially my whole career. So getting out of college, and back in about 05 is when I started getting into real estate. So by the way, many people have much more gray hair than I do, but so I've seen a couple things now, but you know, since 05, in a small partnership with this guy named Pete Rex and his brother, Rob, that's how we started off, just three people getting together to buy deals. And Pete is still my partner after all these years, 20 years I've been together with the same person. Rob is now doing something else that's amazing in the media space. So he's not a day-to-day operational partner with us anymore. But Pete, I'm still investing with him. So that's how I got started though. Pete had an idea to get to break into business through real estate. And when he approached me, I was it really resonated with me because I felt like I wanted to achieve something about create long-term wealth for my future family. I was young. I'm in my early 20s at this point. Got out of undergrad and was chasing a career in public service. So I don't know if this is TMI, but that was my passion at that point. September 11th, I was about 20 years old, and my response was to go into public service. I became an elected official. That's a whole another set of story. But the reason why it resonated with me and getting into real estate was because I felt like it wasn't that long ago that I'd been in college, and I was living in an apartment, saying to myself, the landlord here is not doing much for me. I can barely get him on the phone, and yet I'm paying him every month. Like, there's something magical here. So this is just how young people think, and if they don't know how to break into things. And I'm from a working class background. So when Pete approached me, I was full of ambition, and I trusted him as a partner and someone who had massive integrity, an incredible amount of hard work, like a work ethic, and someone that I knew was going to get some stuff done. And same thing for his brother. So that's how we started off. We started buying 4-unit buildings. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to ask, did you start in single family, or it sounded like right in that quadplex, fiveplex area?
It was like that bootstrapping thing, 2005. So doing things you can't do anymore, like the leverage you can get back then. Just that, stuff that we wouldn't do. And so for a couple of years, we looked really smart, Matt, and we felt like we were on top of the world. And things were going fine. The economy was okay. It was doing really good. And we just kept rolling into more deals. And before you knew it, we had a small portfolio of, let's call it 100 units. And to me, that was like enormous back then. And, I think we were a little proud of ourselves. And then, of course, the great financial crisis happens. We were one of the least prepared because we had a lot of leverage, not a lot of capital reserves, and didn't have the operational background that we do now. So when times got tough, it was really tough. And then we had to go through all of that together, which we did. So I'll stop there.
Do you remember what your LTVs were at that certain point? Did you have floating rate debt, or was most of it fixed with just low equity at the time? What did that look like?
Yeah, there just wasn't a lot of equity in each deal because it wasn't required. So we're like, okay, well, if we don't need to put a lot of equity and the banks are giving us more debt, let's just keep taking more debt. So that's how you think when you're young and inexperienced. You don't realize, hey, actually, that's introducing massive risk.
And what were some of the learning lessons you took as you navigated from, let's call it 07 to 12, which were really tough years for the real estate profession? What were some of the learning lessons that you kind of took from that, or how'd you weather that storm?
Well, number one is thank God that you got great partners. And because when times get tough, people scatter. Typically, but we didn't do that. I would say we got very in each other's faces from time to time because of so much stress, but we never really considered bailing on each other. So just working things out with partners that you trust and have your back and are going to see it through. I think that was important. And also just grit, determination. A lot of people just handed back keys without even thinking about it. That wasn't our team. We're like, all right, let's work it out and avoid the worst of it. We're going to get hit here a little bit, but let's avoid the worst of it. And let's do the best job we can for the banks. And quite frankly, we didn't even know who the banks were at that point. So many had failed, and private equity groups had bought the bank. And then another private equity group bought that private equity group. It was just insane time. So, but through perseverance, sometimes you'd be on a phone call all day to try and reach someone to work it out with.
Right.
And right. Just going through all that teaches you just grit, determination. And then you have lessons of, hey, you got to become a stellar operator. If you're going to own assets, you got to know how to operate them yourself.
And were you managing your own assets at that time too?
We started off when it was small, like small for us, like, a building or two. I was doing my own stuff, leasing my own apartments, which is great, because you can't pay your bills unless you fill your apartment. So you really feel that it's not ephemeral to you. It's concrete. It's like, all right, boom, this is my deal. That unit is vacant. I'm looking at it today and I'm going to fill it tomorrow. You know, so we did when it was like smaller, quote unquote, a couple of buildings. Yeah, we were doing it on our own. And then we tried to hire a property manager because it became a little bit more to deal with and it wasn't right in our backyard necessarily. But that's a lesson, right? So it was hard to find great people that were trustworthy. So we got people stole from us. You know, they weren't putting the rent in on, they were collecting the rent, not putting it in on time or not at all, like literally stealing or not turning units when they would tell us they're turned, ready to rent. And then you go up there and you try and, you know, audit everything and you do audit everything. You're like, wow, this is nothing. Nothing's happening like you described. So anyway, you learn a lot through all that.
I want to get into the property management piece because I know that's something that you guys have taken on and do at scale at this point. But before we get there, this idea of 2008, and a lot of people are saying, you know, this time right now in commercial real estate is much different than 2008, which is kind of my view on it. But how would you kind of compare and contrast what you saw during the GFC with what we're seeing today in the commercial real estate market?
Yeah. And just to round out my story for your listeners, the benefit of like, that was a genesis, the origin of the story. And then it has like I think a happier ending or a happier middle phase. I'm only, you know, I'm in my low 40s. I want to be in business for 50 more years. Right. But in 2011, I joined Pete full time, you know, left my career in public service, joined him full time. And that entity that we stood up to bet on the great financial crisis, all the distress coming out of the great financial crisis, it bought $2 billion of asset total value. So 17,000 apartments, which is why when you look back and I'm like, all right, a four unit building to some people is very big. It's a big deal. They're doing something else on as their full-time job. But for us, like we're now buying 150 unit type buildings and above. So that would be our buy box, at least 100 units and above. And we did 17,000 apartments, like I said, in Florida and Texas. And then in 2019, we stopped buying. We just thought it was really a frothy market. It was a completely changed environment from where we started, which is like, you know, betting on the post GFC. Right. So now I can get into your question. Maybe is your question is like, how is it different or how is it the same? Yeah.
Well, I'll just comment. That's a heck of a middle term to that story right there, that we were doing some quadplexes, right into some trouble through the GFC and came out of it with 17,000 units. And oh, by the way, in 2019, I kind of saw this problem coming. So that's where we're at in the story.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, credit to Pete Rex, my business partner, is amazing. And I love working with him as a partner and our team too. It's just like, yeah, the team that got built to go execute that was superb, and I was just it was joyful to be part of it. It's so much fun when you're winning in business. It's like the best feeling, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's a joy.
So looking now towards where we are in the commercial real estate market here in 2024, early Q1 2024, compare us a little bit and contrast us a little bit with what you were seeing and experiencing during the GFC.
So from my vantage point, probably everyone has a different story based on geography, I would imagine, right? So my best experience, like direct on the ground, boots on the ground, like deep in it, is Florida. So Florida post great financial crisis, I would liken it to, it's much more of like a physical distress play. So a lot more had been taken over by the banks. So in the early part of that, the firm that bought all the $2 billion, we were buying a lot of bank-owned assets. So for maybe your listeners, like the bank doesn't want to own an asset, right? They take it over because the person that's holding the note, like they can't pay their bills and they're completely washed out. Maybe they've given up entirely and the bank says, all right, cool, we have to at least rescue something of the money that's trapped inside this deal that we're on the hook for. So they take it over and they'll try to have like a property management team run it and, you know, improve it. And that way they can sell it and get it off their balance sheet. So we're buying a lot of deals direct off balance sheet of real estate, REO, it's called, real estate owned assets from the bank. And many of them were just in massive distress, physical distress positions. And because Florida got hit very hard by the great financial crisis. So many people counted Florida for dead. And they thought it was going to be a lost decade because tourism was a big driver of the industry, of the whole state industry. Now, looking back, Florida's it just raged. It did so well. It started getting corporate relocations and different economic drivers and diversified its economy. And now it continues to be a big story. So I think it's way different. I don't see any of that physical distress. You know, I've toured Florida deals the last couple months, and there's nothing like that right now. The distress is more of a financial distress. It's more like what I described at the top of the pod here. It's you know, they got their debt wrong. A lot of good, even really good operators and sponsors, like, they just got their debt wrong, and costs have risen like this, and rents have risen like this. Mm-hmm. So for people who can't see my hands, like, costs have skyrocketed, obviously, and your rents haven't kept up. And so that shock is what I see is the big difference of, we're not seeing a lot of bank-owned, our banks taking back keys yet. Maybe we will see it in the next 12. I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah, why do you not think so? And I guess I'll contextualize that with saying that my big mantra for 2024 and 2025 is you will see a lot more loan mods than you will see foreclosures. And the reason being is because there is a little bit of scar tissue from the GFC where banks would go and foreclose on these properties, and they may or may not want to own the property. They sure do not want to manage the property. And right. I think a lot of banks thought, okay, we're going to foreclose on this asset. It's like a single family home. We'll sell it off at auction. We'll sell it off to the flippers out there. There's plenty of them. And then they ultimately in the GFC foreclosed on some of these bigger commercial assets. And they're like, oh shoot, nobody has money to mm-hmm. go buy these things. And you can't just stroke a $100 million check unless you're Blackstone or the feds and things like that. So I think that there's a little bit of scar tissue there to where you're going to see modifications with operators who are net NOI positive and who are also communicating with the banks through their process and through the different levers that they're trying to pull to make their debt covenant payments. So would love to get your perspective on it, but that's just to put that on record in case I'm wrong on the internet. That's what I think is going to happen over the next 18 months.
No, I think that's sharp. And one reason why I don't see the banks is just kind of like foreclosing on a lot of things is if you just look at so some of the scar tissue around the great financial crisis, groups or especially, you know, government sponsored entities like Fannie and Freddie, they're just not going to allow higher leverage than 65 or mm-hmm. 70. You know, they just weren't going to allow that. So you have room. You have a lot of equity in deals. And what I feel like what happened in the lead up to the great financial crisis, people like me in the smaller end were taking up to 90, 95% leverage. And so if pricing comes down 30%, the person has no money in the deal, and they're just really incentivized to kind of walk away and just say, all right, I'm going to go do something else with my life instead of trying to rescue this deal. So I think what's happened now is that most of the deals that are out there are somewhat conservatively leveraged. Maybe someone took mezzanine debt. It's called mez debt or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you've only levered your deal up to 75%, pricing is down 25 to 30%, you're still going to keep fighting. Right.
Right.
And the bank's like, all right, well, my space is protected. Like, what I have in the deal is protected. Even if your equity's wiped out because pricing came down 30%, that's on you. That's on the investors in the deal. So my asset's still worth what my debt note is, and that's why I feel like it's a more protected scenario now. It's not like, I don't see like a meltdown happening like we saw in the GFC.
Yeah. The only caveat I would throw there, and would love to hear your perspective on this, is if they have big deposit fees. So if it's a small regional local bank, not B of A, JPM, Citibank, those, New York Signature, as we're recording this in early March, is getting hit with this right now. But if there's depositor flee and you're net negative on properties, then it's okay. Now I'm in a tricky situation that I have to figure out what to do with this property. But for the most part, if you're an insurance company, if you're GSA backed, you're probably, or agency backed, you're probably going to be okay in that situation.
I agree. And that's a really good point. I don't understand that space as well as, you know, most of what we do is agency debt now. Mm-hmm. So I don't, maybe there will be a little bit of, you know, nuclear meltdown in that little, because a lot of community banks will take the note on the smaller type deals. And there could be some trouble there, and then that could spin on itself. So that's an interesting take. I think that could happen on the smaller deals. Yeah.
Right. Well, take us now to where you are today. Specifically, what I'm interested in talking to you about is this idea of property management. You all have scaled a business of property management across both Texas and Florida, and I think I saw a little bit of South Carolina in my research as well. Yeah. You were mentioning earlier on some of the things that you maybe got burned on as you were learning this business and scaling this business and things like that, and specifically around auditing. So when I think of property managers, I think of people who are really, really good project managers. We know these leases are coming up in 3 months. We know this issue is coming up in 6 months. We know we have an insurance bill coming in 9 months. And oh, by the way, this big issue is coming in 2 years. They're just thinking about a holistic picture, not managing a property day to day. So I would love to hear, like, what's your philosophy on property management? How have you been successful to scale a property management business across multiple different markets? And I don't know, maybe some good questions will come up from there from my end.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. So what I've been describing so far is that we're back in things on the real estate private equity side. So that's allocating capital into acquiring in place assets that we would target in primarily Florida and Texas. We're opening a couple more states. So that's a different business. Now getting into, and that's called ATX acquisitions. So it's a private real estate, private equity, traditional type play. What we're talking about now is a company called ResProp Management. And ResProp Management has 12,500 units today, as of today. It's got a pipeline to 15,000 units. And it's a third-party services provider for any owner of residential real estate. So apartment homes in Florida and Texas, primarily serving like 100 unit plus type you know, properties. So yes, we've scaled that business, and that kind of grew out of our vertically integrated play that I described between 2011 and 2019. During that time, our property management was all what would be called in-house, if that makes sense. So we only served deals that we had an ownership stake in, and we pivoted that company. Once we started selling a lot of our owned portfolio, we pivoted to become a third-party shop. So now we're open for business called ResProp Management. Anyone out there that needs that, they're an amazing team, best in class, I believe, in Florida and Texas. And so some of my philosophy around property management is, you know, first of all, you have to think like an owner. That's number one. You know, I think you have to be like owner obsessed. You have to know your true customer. But property management, man, is you have many customers and many stakeholders, like residents, right? That's a very big deal. You have to keep your residents very happy in your deals. Vendors are critical to making your operation run. Government entities, like, you know, different groups that are involved in the area. But the number one thing is to get it right for your owner. And so you have to have an owner mindset. And that's why I think ResProp is so great, because it grew out of a team that was like completely, the mindset was maximize this deal. Everything you do, every single day, every dollar counts. So that's my ultimate philosophy about property management. Don't ever step over a dollar. Every single dollar counts, because it's all about cash flow. It's all about NOI. And that means two things, guys: grow your top line and protect your expenses. Like, and take care of your bottom line. And everything you do for an owner, they're just going to love you. If you do those two things, boom, they're going to love you.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that comes down to communication as well. Problems don't get easier with time. If you've run into any issues with property managers, usually the stem of the issue is not necessarily the problem. It's the fact that you waited 7 days to tell me that there was this problem, and now we're already a week behind. So I always look for transparency and communication. And even if it's our fault, not your fault, all those sorts of things, just be transparent.
100%. Yeah. That's wisdom right there. I mean, we like to say like bad news first, you know,
right.
Good news is so simple. It's just easy. You know, we released, you know, 15 apartments last month. Like that's going to get to us or to the owner. What you really want to do is get the bad news out first. That way they can prepare for it because their money on the line, really, that they're stewarding almost always other people's capital as well. So yeah. They're the ones that need to really have that bad news.
So you said Texas and Florida, obviously two very high growth states. You said you might be interested in other markets as well, depending on the opportunity. South Carolina was one that I pointed out. Yeah. What do you look for in markets outside of Texas and Florida where you all directly own assets? What else are you looking for in market where you would want to offer your third party services?
On the third party management side?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. A couple of things. I would say number one, it would have to be a place where we feel we can get some scale within some reasonable amount of time. So really it kind of makes sense to have over 1,000 units in a market because then you can pay for a regional manager, which is important to have like that boots on the ground oversight and leadership. I think the regional manager is kind of a linchpin, leader that within the property management stack for the type of deal I'm talking about. You know, you have to have someone who's like driving stuff every day and just checking on things and giving, you know, doing the audit work and lifting up people and just saying, hey, you know, you're here every day. I'm seeing something different than you are, you know? So basically it would be like any place that if it's a great owner and we want to work with them, it could be 200 units, but we want to have a clear path to being over 1,000 units in that market. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Do you, I'm interested in business development and sales tactics for different types of verticals. And this happens to fall in one. Do you have a list of owners in those areas that you're like, hey, these are the owners I would love to work with for these reasons? How do you go about just trying to find open up new doors and open up new business for yourself?
Hey, fellow investors, before we dive into our next segment of the show, I wanted to take a quick moment to talk to you about a fantastic opportunity for you to invest with me. As you know, here at Ice Cream with Investors, I'm passionate about real estate investing and helping you navigate the exciting world of wealth creation through real estate. And that's why, for the first time, I'm thrilled to tell you about an opportunity for you to invest alongside of me. Over the past 3 years, I've been investing in multifamily, mobile home parks, car washes. I've even become the bank and lent out money to fellow real estate investors on a short-term basis. And now you can come join me. If you'd like to jump on a call and learn more about this opportunity, head to icecreamwithinvestors.com/invest and find a time for us to connect. And now back to the show.
That's so funny you asked this because I'm just reviewing our business development plan with our team right now about how to do this very question. And I could probably learn from you quite a bit because your experience I saw, it looks pretty amazing on the biz dev side. But it's a combination of things. And the thing about this client development in the property management space is it almost always happens around two events. One is a transaction happens. So a deal trades or a change of management. Like mid deal, something's going really wrong. Like your current operator is just like tanking the deal. And then a new property management company steps in and says, all right, I have a new vision, a new energy, a new plan. I'm going to step in and take this place from maybe you've tanked it into the 80s in occupancy or 70s we've seen. And the new, the pitch is like, all right, here's how we're going to market differently. Here's how we're going to, drive occupancy. Here's what we're going to do with pricing. So that's your two options. One is that you're dealing with an owner who's looking to acquire. And so that's a whole set of things that we'll do for that owner. We'll give them local market intel. We'll help them with their underwriting. We'll sometimes, you know, we're going to review their underwriting for them, talk about their inputs, help them think about their comps, help them kind of nail whether or not they want to go hard at a deal. And then if they win the deal, all right, boom. Rest prop, you're our team. You're going to do my due diligence and let's go. We're off to the races. As long as I close, we're going to win that deal.
Right. You know? Gotcha.
Now, the other one, the change of management is tough, man, because the switching costs in our industry as you know, you're a property owner, it's so hard, man. Because everyone's like, everyone theoretically says, yeah, you know what? I hate my property management team. They're doing terribly on this deal. But to actually pull the trigger, everyone gets scared.
But I don't hate them that much.
Yeah, yeah. Because everyone, at the end of the day, they're like, you know what? It's going to take 3 months for this new team to get on board and really figure things out and like drive, really, really drive stuff. So maybe I'll just give my team 3 more months and, you know, message to owners, you know, like if something's going wrong, it almost always happens. Like things spin on themselves, like more bad things pile up. It's like a train wreck, you know, like a slow moving train wreck. So you should just bite the bullet and really consider making your move.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think, to your point around switching costs, sometimes it's easier to, depending on where you are in the deal cycle, to sell a deal and just move out of that property than to flip property management companies.
Yeah, that happens. So there's other interesting spaces though, just to complete this answer, like maybe there are some banks that are going to take over some deals. So we'd like to get on some servicing sheets for lenders. If it happens in 8 or 12 months that you know, a bank needs an option to say, hey, you know what, we took back this asset, you know, which groups are on our short list to go take it over? Well, maybe that's one. Maybe that's us.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of that. Yeah.
We're just going after different ideas. Also, we've opened up like an affordable housing component, and I think we're doing a great job for our current owner. So now we have that as a capability, and I think we've been nailing it. So it's very detail oriented work. You have to get all the administrative stuff right. So I think we can really be a new player in that space, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that, because one of the things I'm pretty high on for people that are getting new into this industry, specifically if you're looking at investing passively in a deal, is you do want to understand who's going to manage the property from a day-to-day perspective. Either it's done in-house or it's outsourced. Two options, no other options, right? If it's outsourced, what does that property management group do? What do they focus on? Because managing a self-storage facility is different than managing a multifamily. I would even argue that managing an A-class multifamily is completely different than managing a C-class workforce development multifamily. So talk to us a little bit about kind of your buy box that you specialize in. And you mentioned opening up kind of an affordable housing segment in your property management. Why are you doing that? What are some of the differences you're going to have to switch in your systems to do that?
Yeah. So we're talking about two separate businesses here. Like, so ATX is a separate entity from ResProp. So let me just hit that real quick. Sure. If you don't mind. ATX acquisitions buy box would be, it's actually not specific to multifamily. Our fund allows us to be asset class agnostic. So we could technically really buy any in-place asset that has cash flow. So on occasion, we'll look at different triple net deals or medical office buildings or something that comes our way that seems interesting, or a hospitality play that's maybe out of favor. So we've done a couple hospitality deals. But on the multifamily side, that's where we have the deepest relationships, broker networks. So our buy box there is number one, great neighborhoods. It can't be like a tough, you know, dangerous neighborhood. We're just not going to do it. You know, life's too short. We've done a number of those in our past, and I personally have been in, you know, in some crazy situations. So I'm not, you know, we're not going to do that, because ultimately, I think also looking back with hindsight, those neighborhoods tend to not transition. You think they're going to. But there's something sticky about it, the challenges that it faces. Like, just buy into an area that you really know for sure is going to be basically a short shot bet in 5 years is going to be as good or better as when you're buying into it. That's going to do so much work for you. So got to be a great neighborhood. And then definitely not looking for a turnaround story at this point. You know, I like the Buffett mentality. It's like, hey, if you're looking for a turnaround, you're probably going to be the one that gets turned around. So I don't want to buy like a really underperforming asset. I'd rather just buy something that's 95% occupied, but for whatever reason, the current owner, they're not optimizing it. We see easy little plays that we can juice up revenue and do a better job operationally. or there's a value add component to it where we take the unit spec up to a better rehab program. But also a 2023 deal. We just looked at one in Jacksonville that we got excited about. We're not going to get to best and final, but that's an amazing play right now. If you can buy below replacement cost, in a deal that's leased up and a new vintage deal, that's amazing. I think that's a really strong play. Because someone, when they developed it a couple of years ago, they penciled out a different cap rate that they would exit on, and that cap rate's not there, right? So all that work that they did and all the lease up, and they're just not going to get paid on it. So someone else who buys the deal is going to do well.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I tell this story to some of our sophisticated investors, but in 2019, we decided to make a transition to more Class A apartments, buying them straight from the developers. And the reason for that is value adds defined differently for a lot of different people. Sometimes value add means pumping in a bunch of CapEx and renovating the property. Sometimes it's just leasing up the property. The developer thought that they've got it 30% leased up. They're finished with the property. They can absolutely keep more meat on the bone by doing that work, but they want to go put shovels in the ground somewhere else and do something else. So if our value add is you've got this 30% leased up, we'll buy it from you like it's 85% occupied. And our job is to get it to 95% occupied, because if we do that, then that's our little value add and our meat on the bone. And the reason why we went there is because we saw what was happening in the industry. It got a little frothy. Cap rates were suppressing. And a C-class deal that should be trading at a 10 cap was trading at a 5.5 cap. An A-class property, which should trade at a 4.5 cap, was trading at 4.25. So when things revert back to the mean, there's less room for it to fall. I'm not saying it's completely de-risked, but that's how we were de-risking ourselves going into that environment. And it's played out pretty well, because I know plenty of my peers in the industry who bought those $60 million properties that were C-class at a 5 cap. They've pumped in millions of dollars. The NOI is through the roof from a revenue, or the income is through the roof, but their debt payments have ballooned so far that things are reverting back to the mean, and now they're $30 million underwater. Basically got cut in half for doing everything right except for the market going against you. So I shared my long tirade there, but anything you would add to that or response on that?
No, I like that play. That does take it's a way to add a lot of value and to capture a lot of value. I love that play because you are taking some risk. But if you're betting into the right area and you really have a path to go from that 30 to 90, boom, you can. I'm sure you've done very well on a couple of those.
Yeah,
That must have killed it.
And two, the expense ratios are just much lower on newer properties. I'm not saying they're zero. I'm not saying nothing can't happen. But what we have typically found is when you buy them from good builders and good areas, you're not going to be pumping in millions of dollars to change out 1960s pipes in apartments kind
totally.
Of thing.
Yeah. It was such an easy underwriting when we looked at that 2023 deal in Jacksonville. It's like very straightforward, very minimal, you know, CapEx reserves, but you're not doing any CapEx work. Right. So, it's a story of what's your vacancy, what's your rent growth, what can you do with the asset? You know, can you add value in the revenue side mostly? Yeah.
The last question I want to ask you is, since we're talking about Jacksonville, is you work in two markets that are getting hit pretty hard right now with insurance rates, specifically Houston and Texas and anything in Florida right now. How are you underwriting insurance? It used to be we typically throw on 3-5% growth rate. I'm seeing some properties now where insurance costs have nearly doubled. They're 40% of revenues, those sorts of crazy stories out there. What are you doing to mitigate that risk? How are you underwriting insurance costs?
Yeah, it's a good question. So in Florida, we focus on the big four markets. So Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, and really all of South Florida. And then in Texas, we're really focused on Austin and Dallas. So we try to stay away from Houston. But still, same thing. Dallas and Austin have like hail damage and other things that have impacted their insurance. Jacksonville, a recent example here is that we have a deal under contract. And, you know, so as we underwrite, we'll ping all of our insurance brokers and we'll get actual quotes. So that's one way. So you know where you're going in is and how we handle it is what you said. We apply like a accelerator. I think it's 5% per year, which is it's very unknowable. But being in the market, we're actually seeing things stabilize and it's starting to come down. And we see a lot of owners and what they have as well, because we operate for other groups, not just ourselves. So we're seeing other people. And I think it's starting to moderate in Florida as of right now, and actually coming down a little bit, because they've had a good, pretty good year without a lot of claims. So it's a risk to the deal. Yeah.
And what our listeners just heard is that Dan is going to send me his insurance broker after the meeting.
Oh, 100%.
We're seeing a little bit of still the opposite right now.
So. Are you? Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. We have two or three ping on every deal, and they'll get right back to us. And
yeah,
I'll say, cool. When you win the deal, call us up.
Yep. Got it. Well, Dan, I want to switch us now to our last round. We're calling this the four toppings. Our first one is, what is your favorite book, or what is a book you've read recently that's given you a paradigm shift?
I mean, my favorite book would be The Gospel, you know, number one. But if I have to give an answer about, book more recently or whatever, it would be Buffett's Shareholder Letters, like all of them. So just try to get through from whatever it is, 1959 or something, all the way to today. And it's just packed with wisdom, and just it's amazing to see their approach like unfold over so many years. And then the last one was very touching, actually, the way he gave his a shout out to Munger, who just passed away. The first page was all about, you know, him being the architect of the Berkshire Hathaway strategy, which is a lot of humility, right? It's like Buffett's amazing on his own, but he gives so much credit to his partner. So it's just a fascinating read them all.
His Howard Marks Oak Tree, and then Jeff Bezos's Amazon Share Letters are all three good ones. If our listeners are looking to nerd out and put themselves to sleep over,
those are amazing too. Yeah, amazing. Yep.
Our second topic is, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Well, two things I would say. Like number one is it's advice, but it's more like belief. Like I would give so much credit, and I'm so thankful for my parents, and like it's almost like advice, but just belief. Like, didn't even know what I wanted to do, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, but they just had belief, and they basically said to me, anything you want to do, we believe that you can do it. And that was like growing up just like so powerful, and because it gave me a lot of confidence. And so I think that was awesome. But if I had to give like one piece of advice that really resonates with me is sorry to keep using Buffett's name here, but like Buffett just says, number one thing, invest in yourself. And I've always thought about that. And I still think about that. And I think a lot of people think, oh, I got my master's, I got my bachelor's degree, I'm done investing in myself. And that is a complete opposite of how you should think. You should think, all right, I need to read books and listen to really great podcasts like what you have here, Matt. And I need to be a learning machine and invest in myself, because I want to work for 50 more years. So I want to get better each and every day. So invest in yourself.
Yeah. And my easiest one there is go to the gym. I believe that everybody I know that goes to the gym consistently for 30 to 60 minutes a day can see 100%. Self-improvement with themselves, which will relate to self-confidence, which will relate to other areas of their life. So I'm a big, like, you don't have to spend money. Just go to the gym, go for a walk, do something that challenges yourself physically. And to where over time you'll see a physical change in yourself, which will give you a self-esteem change as well.
I love it. Yeah.
Our third one is, what are you most proud of in your life?
This is another tough one for me, because I feel like I'm not really anything I've been given is a gift. Let me put it that way. Like, anything I've been given is a pure gift from God. And I don't even like to claim credit for anything I've done personally. So I think just like just being a son of God and being someone who tries to just stay humble. Like I just know it's not me, it's him, you know? So, that would be how I answer that, man, is I just try to think of things like that. Like, just, I'm nothing. I'm just dust. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah, I like it. I like it. Well, our fourth and final one is, if you could sit down and eat a bowl of ice cream with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Well, it's Jesus, but if it's not Jesus, then it would be George Washington, for sure.
Okay.
This is one of my heroes, man, as I've read a lot of different books on him, and I find him to be fascinating, and I think he was like a critical, you know, a lot of people think like history just happens. Like I actually ascribe to this great man theory. I think there are some great people throughout history that really changed the course of things. So his selflessness, his ability to step away from power, and just like that is baked into our DNA as a nation. And like, what if we didn't have that? You know, that's why, you know, the current mentality right now is a little scary within the country. So yeah, just sitting down with him, man, just would be fascinating.
Well, Dan, fantastic conversation. If our listeners wanted to reach out to you, learn more about your property management, ATX acquisitions, or you in general, where's the best place we can point them?
First, just call me or text me. I'd love to add value to you in any way. If I can help you even just through a conversation, let's do it. It's 845-629-1808. dfrench@atxacquisitions.com or dfrench@resprop.com. That'd be the other ways. So
dfrench might be the most gangster email address I've ever heard. So dfrench, on that
appreciate
note, dfrench, thank you for coming on the show.
That was fun. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Ice Cream with Investors. If you like what we serve you here, it would mean the world to me if you would like, subscribe, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app.